Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longtime journalist reporting on food, health, and the environment, and this is our second year, actually the beginning of our third year, of the Connect the Dots radio program here. Every week on Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment, the health of our communities, society, and the planet Earth, the health of our systems, our social orders, our food, water, air, and earth. And of course, we're living in a time of tremendous challenges to health and habitat. And that's why every week on Connect the Dots, I bring in different experts, authors, scientists, and thought leaders to talk about the kinds of things we need to pay attention to restore, rebuild, and redress so that we have healthier systems that really support health and life on Earth. And every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss a different facet of that. I usually begin the program before speaking with our guests, and today we have a really terrific guest on a great topic for you. But I usually give a little intro so that you can get some updates about activist opportunities and breaking news on the advocacy front across the range of issues that we cover on the program. So this week I have two different things for you. One is the building of pipelines. I've done a lot of reporting on fracking, as many of you know, and we've had many advocates, scientists, geologists, physicians, and other experts on the program throughout the last couple of years talking about this topic. And recently, concerns have extended from the locations where wells are being drilled and, you know, water and food systems potentially contaminated, to the pipelines that are being rushed through and built all across the landscape of our country in order to rush the gas from its origin point to the points of sale and use and export internationally. So we featured pipelines before on the program. Today we do have an update on the Tennessee pipeline, which is an extension of an existing pipeline that's designed to pick up gas produced in Pennsylvania and carry it through Pennsylvania and New Jersey in order to deliver it for export or to its end users. And the concern is that the pipeline, which is going to be built and extended, the Tennessee Pipeline Extension Project, is being pushed forward even though this pipeline goes right by sensitive environmental areas of the Delaware River watershed, which supplies the water supply of millions of people downstream. The Delaware River Basin Commission, which is the agency, the interstate agency that's responsible for coordinating environmental protection along the Delaware, which is, you know, basically abuts and runs through several different states, is charged with protecting that precious resource, but unfortunately, without any study, has just kind of is rubber stamping the construction of the Northeast Upgrade Pipeline, as it's called. And once this rubber stamp goes through, has gone through, clear cutting of lands, felling of thousands of 70-year-old trees has just begun in the last few weeks. There are going to be a host, there have been petitions to the federal government, and there are going to be a host of actions and meetings around this tragic occurrence. Listeners who are interested in participating by signing a petition, attending a meeting, or supporting in any way are warmly invited to go online to DelawareRiverKeeper.org. That's DelawareRiverKeeper.org, and they are coordinating action on the front to present this. And that's our first featured action of the day. Our second action is, as we've reported on the show, and we've had a couple of shows over the last month or so about this, plans to proceed with fracking in New York State are temporarily on hold pending a health review that basically the New York State Department of Health Commissioner had assessed was incomplete and needed further development. So this stalled what some feared would be the green lighting of fracking for New York State just a couple of weeks ago, missing an important deadline. We had several shows about this, and you can catch up in the Connect the Dots archive to learn about this more in depth. But in any case, the group called Concerned Health Professionals of New York, whom I've featured on this show and I've covered their activities in both the Huffington Post and Alternet, are calling for a comprehensive health impact assessment, and as we speak, are readying for delivery a letter to Governor Cuomo from statewide and even national healthcare professionals. So if you are a doctor, nurse, public health official, you know, scientist, anybody with professional credentials in that arena, please contact them for supporting this effort to protect the health of New York State residents. You can go to concernedhealthny.org online and write them. Contact them about signing on to their letter for health professionals, calling for a comprehensive health impact assessment, a full assessment of what ways that fracking could risk the health of New York State residents, both upstate and downstate. This has really never been properly studied. At present, the state is only doing a kind of very limited review, which I've covered, and I won't go back into that in great detail. But, you know, Google me on Alternet. You can read the articles about that. You can listen to the shows about that. So please do that and get involved and get active. I try to make a few opportunities every week so that, you know, you don't have to feel bombarded. You can also sign up for my newsletter and get more actions as well. And that brings us to my guest for today's show. I'm so thrilled to have him with us. His name is Philip Ackerman Least. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And when I heard the topic of his book, which is just published, I just literally jumped for joy. It is such an important topic, and I'm so thrilled to have him on the show. It's called Rebuilding the Food Shed, and we'll be talking about that topic, how to create local, sustainable, and secure food systems with Philip Ackerman Least, who is an expert on this subject. He's a professor at Green Mountain College, where he established their farm and sustainable agriculture curricula. He directs the Green Mountain College Farm and Food Project, and he also directs the college's Master's in Sustainable Food Systems, which is the first online graduate program in food systems. That's something that might actually interest some of our listeners. You could pursue a course of study in this online. He has decades of experience working on farms and developing and interacting with regional food system collaborators, and his focus is on reshaping the local and regional food systems from the ground up. Now, is this going to be a great show? Welcome, Philip, to Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, thanks for the kind words. Actually, you know, both farming and teaching are two things that make you humble pretty quickly. So I'm blushing a little on this end. So thanks so much. Really glad to join you today.
This is such an important topic. And, you know, I, as regular listeners know, I have covered health for two decades, which kind of dates me a little. But, hey, you know, we have to have done something to get those few gray hairs that are sprouting.
experience.
So, I mean, I like to describe myself as the original healthy foodie. And I also, you know, have been working as a working journalist, being an advocate for healthy nutrition, healthy lifestyles, you know, all the things that we can do to maintain our health and safeguard our health, with, you know, what we eat being really basic to that. I sometimes proudly say that I'm the person that my friend from childhood years came to ask about grass-raised meats when he first began looking into them, and his name is Michael Pollan. So I've been interested in these questions for a long time, but, you know, there's a lot of sophistication around many years of nutritional research and recommendations about diet, but there isn't a lot of savvy about what it will take for that kind of food to be sustainably available to a wide number of people. And, you know, people go all the way from, oh, well, I'll just go down and buy it from my local farmer's market, and that's my way of supporting a food movement, to people who say, well, we should all leave the city, go, you know, somehow go back to the country, plant our own food, and this is where the world needs to go. And yet, as an urban dweller myself, I mean, I've lived both in the city and in the country, but, you know, this overlooks the fact that there are many people that are not, you know, that don't have that rural grow-it-yourself option. You know, as you know, and issues like, you know, a sustainable food system has to be sustainable for everyone, not just the people that could somehow move back to the land and buy a farm or a property. That doesn't that's not really an option for many people in our country. So we need bigger picture thinking around what a sustainable food system would look like. So can you tell our listeners, first of all, what would be the criteria we should be looking at in defining what we are seeking to create in creating a sustainable food system?
Right. No, that's a great question. You know, I think first and foremost, it's trying to make sure that everybody's at the table in these conversations. And, you know, that may mean that there's some people that we don't know, and frankly, even people with whom we may not be, you know, so comfortable. I think the gathering around the table and the negotiating table, and, you know, as well as the dining room table is really a critical piece here. So, you know, that just this notion of really trying to, you know, create a more democratic food system, you know, by being more inclusive. I think that's, you know, one of the critiques that's been out there with quote-unquote local foods has been that it's somewhat elitist. I think I understand where that came from, but I think we really need to reassess, you know, that whole notion, because I think we can move from local foods and even local food systems to community-based food systems. That's really one of the most critical pieces here. And, of course, you know, ecological sustainability is absolutely critical. You know, as we're moving forward, we also have to think increasingly about energy, you know, which also ties into the economics. You know, we need to also be thinking about, you know, biodiversity as well as the diversity of players that we have in the at the table. So all these pieces are really critical. And certainly, you know, food justice as well ties into this. That's a very important piece. And, you know, we need to look harder, I think, also at the food processing industry as well. It's not just about food production. We really need to look at the whole system, and that's a critical piece for us all.
Wow. That is, you know, I have to say that, and of course I'm not, I cover a range of topics, so I'm not completely immersed in this, but you know, when you talk about food processing, mentioning it there, I have never heard it mentioned in any of these discussions. You know, we're going from a society where, you know, as Michael Pollan has written about and others have written, Fast Food Nation, you know, there are so many things, if you go to a mass supermarket, that are present on the shelves that really don't even come from you know, any kind of discernible plant or natural product that are, you know, packaged as food. And, you know, so it's like on the one end of the spectrum, we have that issue and problem, major contributor to weight gain and a whole host of problems. But on the other end of the spectrum, the assumption is that you just, you know, take the tomato or the plum and just, you know, you should be eating that and nothing but that, and you know, there's kind of a lot in between. You know, just to pick up that thread, because I think I never hear it discussed, what do you envision in terms of food processing? We'll, you know, kind of come back to a better overview, but I'm just fascinated to hear you mention that.
Great. Well, I'm glad you're interested in it, because I think it's a really important part of the topic here, and it is something that we overlook. And, you know, to begin with, I mean, I think it is important to realize that, you know, from an ecological perspective, an environmental perspective, and a health and nutrition perspective, you know, that the fewer steps there are, you know, between, you know, the farm and the plate, the better in many ways. And yet that's also not the reality, you know, for many of us. And for those of us who live in the northern climes, that's certainly something that, you know, isn't always going to happen. So, you know, I think as we're really looking at the local food systems, community-based food systems, we need to think about the processing industry much more. You know, not only do we need to think about how to make it more efficient, but, you know, there's a certain irony here that when we talk about trying to rebuild community-based food systems, we need to be thinking about everyone involved involved in that case. And you know, very often when you look at the processing industry, you know, we've got workers very often who are minorities, people who are low-wage earners, unfortunately. And, you know, that actually, the irony of it is, that really straps their ability to participate, you know, in some of these local food systems and community-based food systems.
You mean, in effect, they work, but they can't even enjoy the fruits of it by eating the food? Is that what you're saying there, by participation? Or
right. You know, I think they're so economically strapped, and, mm-hmm. you know, we're very dependent upon them, you know, within the food sector. And yet, because they're so economically strapped, you know, very often they're fairly limited in their choices and what they actually purchase for themselves and their families. So
wow.
That's one of the things that I, you know, really hope we can bring out here in these discussions. And, you know, it's a move away from local foods as an elitist view and, you know, to something that is indeed more inclusive.
Can you just take our listeners who are new to this topic, you know, from the sort of perspective of local foods alone that currently exists and what that entails, to the next step which you're defining, which is community-based food systems? Can you just kind of define them both and sort of summarize what we're looking at in terms of a transition from one to the other or an expansion from one to the other?
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's a great question. And, you know, I think perhaps to put it in context just with this book project is began discussing the book project with the Post-Carbon Institute and Chelsea Green Publishing. You know, we were talking about local foods and local food systems, and, you know, I had a certain concern about just keeping the focus there, because I do see that we really need to expand our notion of, you know, what we're talking about when we think about local food and local food systems. So, you know, if we just keep it, you know, to the basics of you need to buy local food at your farmer's market, then that doesn't necessarily really get us into all the nitty-gritty of the conversations that we need to think about. We need to be much more expansive, I think, in how we're actually approaching the topic. So as we move toward community-based food systems, you know, there we're talking about the economics, but we're also talking about how to draw in a broader audience into this conversation and really create, you know, as I said earlier, you know, perhaps a more democratic food system so people actually have the ability to weigh in on the decisions. You know, they can do that at multiple levels. I mean, obviously, you can start at home. You can start in your public schools. You can work with senior centers and your public hospitals. You know, and then you can get involved in the regional level, even trying to set up distribution infrastructure that makes sense and actually supports these various initiatives. And then you can move that to the state level. And certainly, you know, then you can have multi-state cooperation as well, you know, as these different organizations and individuals are trying to move forward this conversation. It's really, really important, I think, to expand our notion of what local food can actually mean, because it's a complex task rebuilding these local food systems, and it's not something that's immediate. It's not something that's going to happen in, you know, 5 years or even 10. You know, it's really the work of a generation, and then it's going to take the vigilance of generations to follow to keep it intact. There are a lot of forces that are working against it, and I think we have to be aware of that.
What would a community based food system, for example, look like? What would some of the features of it be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you can look around the country and start to see some, you know, different places where this is happening. One of my mm-hmm. favorite models is Athens, Ohio, and I've gotten to know that by way of one of the graduate students here at Green Mountain College. And it's interesting when you look at a place like Athens that's in a rural area, and, you know, and you know, there's some disadvantages and to actually, you know, rebuilding any kind of an economic system in a rural disenfranchised area like that.
Mm-hmm.
Athens, Ohio has done an incredible job in looking at production, you know, first of all, you know, what's happening in terms of farming, you know, what's actually out there, what's missing, what needs to happen. How do you then also start to tackle the processing sector, you know, because the regulatory environment is only increasingly difficult to negotiate. Then you start looking at the distribution system, so how can you actually do this efficiently, you know, and moving everything back and forth by a farmer's pickup truck isn't necessarily the best way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the outlets, you know, where's this going? You know, if it's just local food for white tablecloth restaurants, we're really not looking at the whole community. If we're really trying to find ways to have local foods penetrate the charitable food system, institutional, you know, the food system, then things start to, you know, really begin to open up. And Athens is one of those places that has really looked hard at their system and tried to think through everything, you know, from the farm to the plate. and trying to be as inclusive as possible, despite the economic odds in a place like that. And that's what really excites me about this.
Mm-hmm. So it's a task of kind of organizing, cooperating. And are these mainly, you know, private businesses? Are they cooperatives? What role does government play? I mean, we could talk about regulations separately, but is there a constructive, supportive role for government as a contributor to making this happen? Or is their role merely regulatory?
Right. I think some of us have a knee-jerk reaction when we think about government and the food system, and I understand and appreciate that and run into that myself. But at the same time, you can have tremendous allies at, you know, the local, the regional, the state, and the national level. It takes time, and it certainly takes effort in trying to make sure you're garnering those resources in ways that are really going to help. But I think the beauty of this is that it really begins at the grassroots level, and then particular communities have to decide for themselves, you know, what's the best approach here? Do we want to do this on, you know, solely on an entrepreneurial level, you know, using private enterprise, you know, as the driver? Do we want to bring in some nonprofits, you know, who are brokers in certain ways? To what degree do we want to bring in the local, regional, state, or even federal governments to help out? And, that's where the complexities really begin to kick in. And so it's a very, very long conversation, and one where you've multiple players have to come in. But I think communities really need to be strategic about those moves. And you know, it requires us to think things out, you know, 5, 10, 20 years in advance.
Wow. So there's really, the kind of the picture that I'm getting of, you know, the farmer is kind of like beyond the family farm to systems and groups of farmers kind of organizing together in a certain kind of way is like the sketch that you're kind of providing. What is your assessment of the role of regulations? I mean, how well are they doing, right now? In what way are they hampering what you're talking about? In what way are they or could they support what you're talking about?
Right. I'll start with the positive there. I mean, I think some of the things we see are positive. There are moves afoot to protect the food supply. I appreciate that. That can go awry fairly quickly sometimes, in my view. Also protecting our waterways, protecting, you know, our air. I think all those pieces are important. So, you know, there is a function for these regulatory bodies, to be sure. But one of the challenges here is that, you know, the regulations aren't always scale specific, you know, so very often they're written, you know, looking at larger farms, looking at larger corporations, larger industry, and, that doesn't work when you're trying to build out these small entrepreneurial enterprises, you know, those can really hamper those kinds of efforts, and, there have been some good moves, thanks to folks like John Tester from Montana and others, who've really tried to make sure as we move forward in food safety regulations, and others have worked on water quality regulations, that we really think about the scale at which we're trying to apply these things. And if they're not scale specific, then frankly, we've got a huge problem ahead of us for rebuilding these community-based food systems. So I hope that's one of the things that's coming out loud and clear. I think we've too readily polarized the discussion, and we're ready to throw government out the door. You know, government does have a role here. But at the same time, we've got to really participate in those regulatory processes as much as we can to make sure, you know, they're not overblown and they don't create situations where it's just virtually impossible for the smaller scale farms and processors to do their business, or even when it's almost impossible for local communities to move forward and advance the ideas and initiatives that they have.
So, you know, I hear you're referencing there to the Food Safety Bill S-510 that, was in debate and passed. I guess it was in 2010, I guess it passed, or was it 2011 by the time it passed? I can't remember. But in any case, I wrote about that. I covered that quite extensively on the Huffington Post. And I was basically the sole reporter that was arguing for, as you mentioned, Senator Tester, his amendment, which helped introduce do some concept of scaling. One of the things that I was frankly surprised about was how limited public knowledge was about the very risks that a food safety bill that kind of writes the law on a template that basically is looking only at the mass suppliers and isn't looking down to these intermediate stages, you know, that really can function in a very harmful manner if the the mid-level and artisanal level suppliers and producers, if they don't have a level of the bill that, that supports them. And ultimately, the Tester Amendment began to break that ground. Do you have any organizations or advocacy groups that you like and would refer our listeners to stay informed about how to participate when there are opportunities to shape or fund, you know, regulatory bodies like the FDA in this instance, so that, you know, what they're doing is helping rather than hurting, you know, the project of creating sustainable food systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of organizations that I really appreciate that are looking at these policy issues, and, you know, they range across the country. Certainly the Center for Rural Affairs is very important. The Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy is also an excellent organization. Mm-hmm. Environmental Working Group, they've mm-hmm. also tackled some of these issues. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think it's important to really think about it from the state level. And one of the things I've been impressed with here in Vermont is that, you know, folks here with UVM Extension, our Extension Service, and others who are also working at the state level are really trying to be proactive, you know, as they're looking at gaps and other certifications, you know, which promote food safety, and trying to find ways, you know, to be an intermediary between the farmers and the regulations. And sometimes that's proactive, as they're trying to actually warn people what may come down the pike, and mm-hmm. other times it's actually once things are set in stone, trying to help farmers understand and interpret that and find ways to actually make the necessary changes, you know, within the economic constraints that they're living in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for those recommendations. You know, we're kind of coming up fairly soon. We've got about another 2 minutes or so before we go into a break. But one thing maybe we could just touch on, and we can talk about it more after the break for station identification. But one of the things that, you know, part of what's happened here in our country is that people have become, you know, kind of habituated to be, you know, kind of at the end point on the food pipeline, you know, with it delivered kind of to them without really being well informed about the route by which it gets there. In terms of supporting the kinds of processes and initiatives that you're proposing, it seems like the average person needs to get, you know, better informed. So, for example, when Pollen says, you know where your food comes from, that doesn't, you know, the answer may not be as simple as it just comes from this farm. It's kind of know what the route is. What do you regard as the most compelling reasons to motivate people to kind of not take for granted what's coming to them down the food pipeline, but to really get involved and inform themselves and get active about promoting the kind of food and food sustainability that we need?
Sure. Well, you know, personal health comes to mind immediately, obviously, and then also family health. And I think that brings out an important point, which I also try to address in the book. You know, I think it's women have been really the protectors of the best practices and so much of what we're trying to do in our food systems, you know, and I think fathers should be fully involved in that as well. But, you know, when you look at the emerging local food systems push, you know, I'm happy to say I think I see women as the drivers. I think they've recognized things that, you know, a lot of us have overlooked for a while. And I think that's because of trying to, you know, protect their own family's health and really understand nature, nurture, and nutrition. I think that's a mm-hmm. really critical piece of what we've got to tackle here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a station break here. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about, you know, what it means to have a sustainable food system with Philip Ackerman Least. Please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is the second half of our show, and today we're talking about rebuilding the food shed, how to create local, sustainable, and secure food systems with Philip Ackerman Least. It's been a really great conversation in broadening our focus from the food in our plates to the food available in our systems and total social context. Really enjoying that. So, you know, let me ask you another question that's been, you know, I think that we need to kind of be better aware of. One of the criteria, which we talked about in the earlier part of the show, for a sustainable food shed is what you call resilience. You know, what do you mean by resilience, and what are the concerns or risks if a food supply is not resilient?
Right. Yeah, the resilience piece is absolutely critical here. And I think, you know, that really is the ability of the food system to withstand various shocks, you know, that are cast at it. And I think we've seen that in a couple of different instances here in the past 5 years or so. You look at everything from Hurricane Katrina to certainly up here in the Northeast. Hurricane Irene, you know, was a huge hit to us. We look at the spike in grain prices, the spike in fuel prices. All of these things really, you know, those ultimately they come home to roost, and they're things that we really need to be able to face and encounter. And so the resilience is the, you know, really the diversity that we build into the food system, you know, and it's also the ability of, you know, I think even neighboring food systems to help out, you know, when we get hammered by certain things in our own local food systems. So it's not necessarily the notion that a particular local food system has to always be independent or self-reliant. It really needs to be interconnected and I think in thoughtful ways as well to other food systems that are in the area and the region.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of like what a non-diversified food system looks like and what the risks of that are?
Sure. You know, I think this past summer, you know, with the drought in the Midwest is the perfect example. And, you know, the fact that our entire nation is so dependent upon the commodity crops that are raised in the Midwest, and that, you know, we don't have a lot of diversity in terms of where those crops are raised elsewhere in the country. So, you know, when a drought hits an area like that, and certainly that's something we anticipate seeing more of, or, you know, it can be the opposite, you know, the floods that also hit the Midwest in the past, you know, it doesn't take too long to look in the Midwest and see how dependent we are upon, you know, all the work that's happening there. But it's not particularly diversified. And so it does make sense, I think, for other regions in the country to be thinking about their own food resources and not always being totally dependent upon, you know, other resources that are fairly far away.
So, you know, for example, like what crops took a hit, and how did that affect the foods available nationwide?
Sure. I think if you just, you know, look at corn, you know, certainly that's the one that's the easiest to, you know, to really understand and target here. You know, the corn prices as the corn harvest, you know, it was clear that it was in serious jeopardy. Corn prices started to spike all around the country. I mean, just at home, I watched my feed bill, you know, for just our backyard chickens, you know, almost double just within a period of 6 months. And when you translate that into a dairy farm, for example, that's very dependent upon grain crops, you know, particularly from corn that's being imported, you know, then it's really going to hit the farmer. It's going to mean that the farmer has a very difficult time, you know, surviving, and it's also going to therefore hit the consumer. And, you know, we see those spikes as well, you know, very often in the food prices that we're paying at the grocery store.
So something like that one crop, for example, hits in a number of different ways that you just mentioned. So there could be farmers going out of business, which creates scarcity. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of a feed crop for meat and dairy, you know, right away with what you're talking about, and therefore a rise in prices there. So, you know, something that occurs in one region where there is not the diversification that you mentioned creates a whole sort of chain reaction of different impacts. And so, you know, you just singled out one, But given the kinds of weather changes and events that we're talking about, you know, there's going to be, you know, there likely could be more than a single impact per year, let's say. And so when you have multiple impacts happening from different directions, you know, what are some of the big picture risks in terms of our food supply that we could be looking at?
Right. You know, I think one of the most critical issues is really what we actually do pay at the grocery store, and in particular for those folks who, you know, are already on the margins. I mean, that's one of my mm-hmm. biggest concerns in all of this is that, you know, as prices spike, it's those people who are hurt the most. They're also the folks who are already suffering the most in terms of food insecurity, and depending upon which figures you look at. But typically we say that about 14 to 15% of the U.S. population is food insecure. So those people are particularly vulnerable in these kinds of situations, and I think that's one of the most serious concerns that we really need to be thinking about. So that's the one that I hope becomes more salient for us as we talk about these community-based food systems and bringing those forward.
Mm. So when you say food security and food insecurity, does that translate into hunger, lack of food? How would you define food security and food insecurity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. And, you know, the term food security sometimes is used in two ways, just in sort of common parlance. I mean, we hear about food security just as a stable food supply, you know, more on the national order. But when we talk about food security and food insecurity in terms of, you know, hunger and the ability to access healthy foods, you know, that takes on a bit of a different notion. So, you know, when we look at populations that are food insecure, it's not just the access to the food itself, you know, to calories. It's also the quality of calories and the ability to be able to, frankly, to make choices about what those calories are going to be. So, you know, the term food insecurity is a really important term out there. And, you know, even when we think about malnutrition these days, you know, we're having to think about it in a different way from the way that we conceived of it in the past. You know, previously, we thought about it meaning the, you know, a certain population didn't have access to food, period, or to X number of calories. But now when we talk about malnutrition, maybe they have access to those calories, but in fact, you know, they're the wrong kind of calories. So it's become more complex as we've looked at the landscape, and we're really trying to figure out how to address these issues.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. As, you know, sort of the writer of a couple of books and have worked with a couple of leading doctors aiming to address the both childhood and adult obesity epidemic, you know, I hear what you say in light of that. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you want to, you know, if you're a famous doctor and you want to make a lot of money, you can write another diet book to add to the pile of diet books, and Americans are perennially concerned about weight loss and diet, but it seems like what you're talking about really stems from the diet that's available. So on the one hand, there are people kind of desperately trying to lose weight to protect themselves from all of the inflammatory processes and the attendant disease that comes from weight gain, excess weight gain, which is rampant in this country and at an epidemic proportion. So, you know, on the one hand, we have these diet books making, you know, an individual's attempt to surmount this, but which you're, you know, with all the doctors kind of trying to motivate and prod us on, but this is all happening within a food context where the choices are limited and tending to drive more and more people due to, you know, the economic downturns and the pressures on the food systems toward, you know, little choice but eating the very unhealthy foods that cause these health problems and their attendant health costs, as well as the human suffering. And it all kind of stems from the food system itself. I mean,
right.
There's an incredible irony there, don't you find?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting as you look at the national maps, and we included a few of these in the books. You know, if you overlay obesity, income, and diabetes, you know, you see these certain regions in the country just, you know, peak. And so it's interesting as we're thinking about local food systems and how to grow those out. And, you know, I certainly don't want to be formulaic about how one addresses, you know, how to build a secure, safe, sustainable, healthy food system, because it's different. You know, you look down south, and I grew up in North Carolina, you know, you look there, it's a completely different kind of problem than it is here in Vermont. You know, and then you go to the Midwest, and speaking with Erica Allen, the daughter of Will Allen there with Growing Power, you know, Erica says, you know, here we are in the land of commodity agriculture with some of the best land anywhere in the country. And in a way, we have a food desert because primarily the crops that we have here that we have easy access to are all commodity crops. And they're very often transformed into things that aren't that healthy. So, you know, as we think about health and nutrition and community-based food systems, we really do need to realize that these are different kinds of problems in different regions of the country and therefore also warrant different solutions. So, you know, I hope no one thinks that, you know, this rebuilding the food shed is formulaic. In fact, it's a push back against that. That we really do have to recognize where we are, where we stand, who we're standing with, and how we need to proceed forward in ways that make sense for our own communities. And you have to do that within a certain economic context and also within certain ecological constraints. And, you know, in some ways, it's kind of a fun problem to have to figure out, but it's very, very serious.
So because of, you know, all of the features of each local environment, both in terms of the kinds of things that grow there, the growing season, the land, the weather, the local economy, the extent to which industrial versus non-industrial, you know, food producers are in place, the tenor and attitudes of the local residents and all of that, it's kind of like all has to be, if you're talking grassroots, instead of being kind of just imposed from without, it has to be kind of grown from this, you know, sort of community upward and therefore individualized. But that's also, you know, it's both a, it's an interesting problem, but it's also more mosaic and complex.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's where I think, you know, this whole enterprise of rebuilding these food systems, you know, is much more democratic in nature because it really does require that we pull these multiple voices together, and it truly is grassroots. You know, it's not government down or corporate down. You know, it's really from communities up.
And that's complex. I mean, because one of the things that I would also guess is that, you know, in regions where, you know, when you were looking at the demographic map that you described, you know, where there's a higher incidence of obesity, low food quality, weight gain, my guess would be that that may also not be, you know, there may be a lack of economic opportunity, there may be a lack of education, there may be, you know, political beliefs or affiliations kind of come along with that whole package that are, you know, both a local and a national problem. So, you know, if you deal with the food in this kind of way, you get into kind of all of that territory, it would seem.
Right. You know, and you look around, and certainly one of the ironies in all of this is that, you know, some of those regions that are, you know, have some of the most dire statistics, you know, their climates where, and also soils, you know, their ecological possibilities there, that it just doesn't make sense that we can't do better, you know, because everything is there and available and the possibilities are ripe, and yet, you know, we don't seem to be trying to find a way actually to, or at least we're not doing a good enough job at pulling, you know, our communities up by our bootstraps, you know, and really rectifying things in the way that we should.
What would it take to kind of get more of that going? What would it take? What kind of supports would be helpful to do that?
Yeah, well, the beauty of it is that, you know, it is happening, and, you know, it's bubbling forward, and I think, you know, we're all beginning to see that this really is a systems issue. It's not just a local food movement. You know, this is really about thinking harder about systems and thinking about local systems and how those are nested within regional systems, which are nested within national systems, which then are nested in international systems. So, you know, we're really beginning to think more complexly, but it's, you know, very often it's the group of concerned citizens who gather around a particular issue. It may be saving the farms in the area. You know, it may be trying to get healthier foods into the public schools. It may be more of a focus on senior centers, hospitals. You know, so very often, I mean, what I'm seeing in these communities is that there's a galvanizing issue, and I don't think it matters which one. You know, suddenly as you start drilling down and tackling one of these issues, all of a sudden you realize that it's attached to the other and to the other and to the other. And it's not that you've got an endless task and an insurmountable task in front of you, but you do have a complex task. And I think, therefore, our conversations need to be more complex. And, and frankly, the media doesn't really allow that very often. You know, we try to translate everything into sound bites. I mean, the fact that we're able to talk here, you know, for 50 minutes or so, you know, about this, you know, is wonderful. It's something that just very seldom happens because these are extended conversations over time, and we've really got to recognize this. You know, we're not going to fix it all, and it's never going to be completely fixed. But it just requires constant vigilance on our part.
Well, one of the things that I thank you for that, because I appreciate and see the need to try to convey some of these complex interactions, which is basically the whole beat of Connect the Dots. I do offer that full hour to people like yourself who are looking at systems. And also my guests come back, you know, to further update listeners because, you know, it's not like just like wake up one day and the problem is solved. It's like it's an ongoing conversation and, you know, that I feel is very important. Now, I have to ask you about my pet topic, which regular listeners to the show are very aware of, which is, you know, I have been a reporter, an early pioneering reporter on the fracking issue in New York State, and broke the story on the Huffington Post, have covered it on Huffington and now on Alternet for the last 3.5-4 years. And one of the reasons that I got into it is because of my health and food background, and immediately saw the implications of fracking in the regions of upstate New York where the food, the sustainable food shed of the city originates. Right. And so, you know, the risk of chemical contamination to the water supply is something I think that's intuitively of concern and geologically of according to geologists of concern. But it's also, you know, the reason that New York is at risk for fracking is because the agricultural regions have been, you know, not supported, failing, and are not doing well. And so it's the, you know, the multi-acred long-term, multi-generational family farm, you know, that is failing in our times, that is really what has left these farmers vulnerable and desperate for the, you know, promises of quick cash, which often aren't, you know, failed to materialize, but they're promised by the gas and oil industry if the farmers lease for fracking. But at the same time, that is taking more agricultural land out of circulation, taking more water out of circulation, and actually contaminating the ground that an urban environment like New York needs to have available nearby for its food shed. I don't know if you're acquainted with this issue, but I'd love to hear any comments or thoughts about that concern that you might have.
Sure, and I think you know, there's places where I've been reading up on it a bit. I mean, certainly you look at New York, you look at Pennsylvania, which has some of the best farmland in the country. You look at North Dakota, which we're really dependent upon in terms of grain crops. You know, just as you look all around at the different places where the fracking is happening, I share your concern and this notion that we're going to be polluting, you know, our agricultural, our food supply, you know, by way of fracking is completely absurd. I mean, in fact, we've done enough pollution already just by the agricultural practices, you know, that really have monopolized the way we operate. Throw on top of that the whole notion of fracking and the possibility of, you know, tainting the water supply and the food supply. And we really need to be thinking about it, you know, much differently. And frankly, I think it's one of the reasons that this notion of a food shed, actually, and thinking about our food shed is really important, because as we start to, you know, sketch out the possibilities in terms of what our food shed might be, you know, hopefully it'll actually make us more aware, really, of what it is we're doing to our land base, you know, to how we're farming, to how we're feeding ourselves. And, you know, as you bring that out, it's really interesting, because there was an author back in 1929, and he's the one who actually invented the term food shed. His name was Walter Hedden, and he was the Bureau of Commerce for the Post of New York Authority. And what he was actually proposing was that we needed to think about food sheds in similar ways that we think about watersheds. And he was thinking about protecting the New York water supply, the New York City water supply. And he started thinking that we also needed to be thinking about food sheds and protecting our food supplies. So being able to build out this notion of food sheds in different areas really gives us a better sense of what it is that we need to conserve and protect. So, the issues definitely come together. There's no question about that.
Well, you know, let me then ask you the most basic question with which we probably should have begun the show, but we didn't. So let's conclude with this question, you know, which is, what is a food shed?
Sure. Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, as you think about a food shed, the bad news is it doesn't exist. The good news is that it can be anything that we want it to be. And I used the pronoun we very purposefully there, because really we can begin to think about a food shed, you know, from, you know, a lot of different angles. I mean, certainly we need to think topographically. We need to think geographically. We need to think about geopolitical boundaries. We need to think about food production, diverse food production. We need to think about the community members and the demographics of the places in which we live. And as we start tinkering with all of those things, and some of that can be done with some of the really neat mapping programs that are out there, we can start to lay out, you know, the notions of what our food shed is. And, you know, my hope in all of this is that we're not actually using really, really tight defining lines. I mean, we have to recognize that these boundaries are porous. And so, you know, we can do ourselves a lot of good in terms of our communities and our own food security in thinking about, you know, food sheds providing porous boundaries, because things are going in and out. And, you know, the food shed isn't the perfect way, you know, to conceptualize all the food that that we actually have coming into our communities. But it does help us actually, you know, give us a handle on where are the peripheries of our control. And I think that's one really important way to think about a food shed. You know, where can we actually exert our influence in order to provide the positive benefits that we're looking for in our community food systems? So if we think about that periphery of our control, I think that's a really helpful way to begin to think about this.
I like that very much. So it's really extending our circle of efficacy, so we don't have to go just from what's on my plate to, oh my God, this nationwide food system that I need to escape from, but really look at what is the range of efficacy that we can all, that is reachable and that we can all share in. Well, I want to thank you so much, Philip Ackerman Leese, for being my guest today. Listeners, go out and get Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. It's available from Chelsea Green, and it's on Amazon. Thank you so much for being with us. And I want to also thank you, listeners, for joining us today on Connect the Dots, talking about rebuilding the food shed and sustainable food and what it takes to build sustainable food systems. Please come back next week for Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We have some terrific guests coming up as well in coming weeks. We're going to be hosting Helen Caldicott, the nuclear expert, Dan Fagan, the author of a terrific new book on Tom's River, Where Toxicity Happened. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Check out my blog, healthjournalistblog.com, and come back next week and join me for the next edition of Connect the Dots.